Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for listening to What Mama Wants. Personally, I think Mother Earth wants far less toxics and more health for her whole planet. This is a chance to hear from educators, citizens, policymakers, and scientists about the role toxics, like fossil fuel emissions, PFAS, and pesticides, are playing in our daily lives. My guest today is Dr. Federica Pereira. Dr. Pereira founded Columbia's Center for Children's Environmental Health and is a professor of environmental health sciences in New York City at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health. Recently, Dr. Pereira's book called Children's Health and the Perils of Climate Change was published. In it, she eloquently connects our climate's health and our children's health to the very same source, fossil fuels. Her illuminating storytelling both shines a light on the damages toxic fossil fuels do to our health, most especially those of developing bodies, and leads us to what we can do about this colossal global problem. It is an honor to have you on What Mama Wants today, Dr. Pereira.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and thank you so much for having me.
Your book, Children's Health and the Perils of Climate Change, is a serious and weighty topic. What drove you to write this book at this time?
I wrote the book as a wake-up call and a call to action. I wrote this book now because over the years I've become so aware of the escalating crisis. It's now termed code red alert for the planet. And also in my own research, I have seen the mounting toll on children's health from pollution from the same sources, the fossil fuel burning sources that have been the primary cause of climate change and global warming and all of its impacts. So I didn't want to stand by and just observe and publish papers in the scientific literature. I wanted other people to see it, to see where we are now and how very vulnerable children are and what effects we're seeing in them today. And also, I wanted them to see that there is much we can do to avert disaster and help children, protect them and protect their future.
I think a lot of people end up just putting their heads in the sand, being completely overwhelmed by what's going on.
That's certainly true.
And I just am struck that you could easily be on a beach in Boca Raton with your feet up, but instead, your nose to the grindstone, turning out a really serious research book.
Yeah. Well, that was something I started during COVID, and I thought, well, it's now or never, and I have the time now. I'm not going into the office for meetings. And I thought, well, now I have an obligation also to put this down in the best way I can. So I tried.
I'm so glad you really do have such a unique perspective on the world. I realized as we were talking that public health is celebrating its 100-year anniversary of being a discipline. And maybe it was 50 years ago that you started looking more into children's health within the public health sphere.
Mm-hmm. Yes. There's been an exponential growth in the scientific understanding of these issues, both of the harm, of the vulnerability of children, of the disparities in the health impacts, but also in the understanding of the benefits of action to protect children and in doing so, protect all of us.
Mm-hmm.
So the first part of the book is very serious. I first describe the full scope of the harm of climate change to children's physical health, their brain development, and mental health, beginning even before they are born. I also lay out the many harms from air pollution due to the burning of coal, oil, gas, and diesel for energy and transportation. This isn't somebody else's problem. 2 billion children worldwide are exposed to high levels of air pollution, and 4 in 10 Americans live with polluted air.
So you lay out the problem in the first half of the book, which is soul-crushing, honestly, completely. Yeah. However, if you can stick with it, on the second half, I felt quite uplifted the fact that we aren't doomed yet. if we were doomed, then it would be okay for everybody to just try to have a nice day however they were possibly able. But if we're not doomed.
So in the second part of the book, I describe the positive trends, the growing power and voice of Indigenous and environmental justice groups, youth groups, spiritual leaders, and artists who are motivating action by governments, communities, and us individuals. And these include youth, mothers, and activists of all ages.
You do such a good job of showing how so many different groups have done creative, miraculous things.
Here are just some of them. Fridays for Future, the Sunrise Movement, the International Youth Climate Movement, Zero Hour Earth Uprising, Extinction Rebellion, Mom's Clean Air Force, the Society of Fearless Grandmothers, and the Elders. In the second hopeful part of the book, I show that we have at hand all the solutions and technologies we need to simultaneously act on two fronts, to protect children today from climate hazards, that's called adaptation, and to attack the root problem by reducing emissions of greenhouse gases and also strengthening the natural carbon sinks or storages, that's called mitigation. And we can do both.
There's a call to action. And I found myself going to my phone and joining different groups as we went along because I want to keep track of what these people are doing. It's good people on the planet making hearty changes that are necessary.
Yes, it's exciting to see the energy and the intelligence of these groups that are really jumping into this fight and making real progress.
Your research that you've done has specifically been on children's health related to air pollution from fossil fuels. And I wondered if you could really explain why children are so vulnerable to toxic particulates that are floating in the air.
Well, air pollution affects developing bodies and brains, starting even when they're in utero. And many of us had grown up thinking the fetus lived a charmed life within the cocoon of the placenta. And we trusted that nature would have evolved a sound defense of the brain and other organs. But a big part of the scientific revolution has been the understanding of just how easily many toxic exposures, not just air pollution, but others, managed to elude these defenses that nature had evolved to protect the fetus. And it turns out that the so-called impregnable placenta, the perfect barrier, is a myth. And we are now seeing associations between air pollution exposures of the pregnant mother and effects on the developing lungs and brains, even at this early stage. And we also see effects of exposures during infancy and early childhood as the brain and lung continue to develop. Pollution is not only a trigger of asthma attacks in children, but now we know it's also a cause of the disease. And that's not all. Exposures also associated with infant deaths and preterm birth, reduced cognition and attention problems, ADHD, autism, and as we are now discovering, anxiety, depression, and other mental health problems in children and adolescents. And we now have evidence that the combination of heat and air pollution may multiply the risk of preterm birth and asthma hospitalizations in children. And also, the developing fetus has not got the advantage of the mature detoxification systems, DNA repair systems, and the immune defenses that are operating in us adults to protect us. So exposures that might not have a great deal of impact in adults can be extremely damaging to the very young, and particularly when they are in utero.
What exactly happens to their health when they're exposed to this particulate matter?
Well, researchers found that when breathed in by the pregnant mother, small particles penetrate deep into the lung with toxic chemicals on their surface. And in some cases, the particles themselves can cross the placenta to affect the fetus. In the infant or child, the lungs and airways become easily inflamed and constricted when exposed to certain triggers like air pollution, causing an asthma attack. What is new in our research is that air pollutants are also toxic to the developing brain.
So if it goes to your lungs, you get something like asthma. What happens if particulate matter goes to the brain of a developing fetus?
Particulate matter is actually quite harmful because it carries on its surface toxic chemicals that get kind of washed out once breathed in and deposited in the lower lung. And those chemicals can cross the placenta, reaching the fetus. And we know that the developing brain is very vulnerable to being disrupted by toxic chemicals or agents because of its extremely rapid and highly choreographed developmental process. And when I mention the speed of development, let me just note that of the 80 billion neurons or nerve cells in the adult brains, almost all are formed before we are born.
Wow. As a clinical social worker who used to work with children with a lot of the same symptoms that you describe in your book, I don't know that I had really connected particulate matter with these very common and growing numbers of childhood complications.
So our research and that of others in the field has shown a link between exposure to air pollution and problems, not only IQ reduction, but ADHD, attention problems, autistic traits, and also mental health problems in the young. And that's new and very sobering.
Extremely sobering and so very common.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's something that has been revealed in the last decades of research, not just particulate matter, but other toxic chemicals that are carried along with particles and all have that ability to interfere with the normal developmental programming of the brain and other organs. So we become more aware of the problem and of the need to prevent these exposures in the first place.
Your book does a fabulous job of really explaining how environmental justice and social justice are joined at the hip and how unfairly the toxic exposures impact people living in poverty, especially those living in close proximity to the petrochemical plants and fossil fuel polluters. Why does environmental justice matter so much on a global scale?
Environmental justice is a huge part of the equation. We know that all children are vulnerable and at risk, but the heaviest burden of climate change and air pollution falls on the least advantaged. And that's true globally and also in the U.S., where communities of color and low income have far greater exposure to air pollution. In addition, every harmful climate change impact, more frequent severe storms and floods, more heat waves, more forest and wildland fires, more droughts, affect the physical and mental health of marginalized and disempowered children the most. And we also know that stress due to poverty or racism and toxic environmental exposures work hand in hand to widen health disparities. Just to take one example, risks from heat waves are greatest in low-income communities of color because of discriminatory policies like redlining that created urban heat islands and where resources to protect children from heat like shade and trees are fewer. Because of disproportionate siting of air pollution sources in the same communities, many children are doubly exposed. Similarly, severe storms in Louisiana and Texas hit Black and low-income communities the hardest. So these children are heard first and worst. And these impacts are compounded by a lack of adequate nutrition, healthcare, education, and social support. And all these factors are intertwined and contribute to the shocking disparities in rates of illness. In the U.S., asthma prevalence in Black children is twice that in white children. Infant mortality also double, and the preterm birth rate is 50% higher.
I felt so angry when I was reading your book. You gave an example of a city that cited places to put their trash, and something like 7 out of 9 of them were in almost completely Black districts. And I think that kind of historical choice making is exactly how we get to twice as many Black people having these exposures as little white children.
It's certainly true. And it's shocking.
It is. If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to What Mama Wants, Less Toxics and More Health. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Dr. Frederica Pereira. She's a professor at Columbia's Mailman School of Public Health and has also won numerous awards, such as the Heinz Award in Environment, for her lifetime achievement and research for the protection of children's health. Her book, Children's Health and the Perils of Climate Change, is hot off the Oxford University Press, and I highly recommend it. Beyond being an author, you've written hundreds of papers, lectured internationally on the subject of pollution and climate change. Dr. Pereira, do you think that climate change catastrophe is a foregone conclusion at this point?
Well, certainly, quote, red alert is the right term for where we are today. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has concluded that urgent action is required in order to limit global warming to minimize the most catastrophic consequences. But sadly, we are on track to reach this threshold within the next two decades. But we can change this trajectory using the solutions now available. Fortunately, governments, businesses, and communities are already seizing the opportunity. And as a result, there's been a sharp decline in the cost of renewables. Government policies have been successful in bringing down emissions, and investment in green energy has grown, and much of this is due to the power of public protest and voter pressure. There's also been the recognition that green energy isn't just benefiting our climate and health, it's good business. Communities that embrace clean energy, solar, wind, electric, are projecting huge health and economic benefits. For example, take California. The estimated net economic value of deaths avoided in 2050 from shifting buildings to electricity is $49 billion, just looking at adult deaths. But if we added in all of the prevented health impacts in children, the economic value would be far, far higher. Also, as a result of this policy shift in California, air quality will be more equitable, and Californians could see 1 million new jobs between 2021 and 2030. 1 million new clean jobs. So wind and solar deployment over the next decade will generate tens of billions of dollars for most rural regions of the country. Even the former coal-burning regions of Appalachia will benefit, and in fact, they would see the largest economic benefits of $65 billion between 2021 and 2030.
I love how there's the both and. On one hand, you're making more money doing important work, moving energy in a different direction. And on the other hand, you're averting all those costs, all those special ed teachers, all those emergency room visits. And so together, it's such a win-win to get away from fossil fuels, right?
Yeah. And we've looked at some of the climate policies and in terms of their health and economic benefits. And one that we analyzed was the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative in the northeastern U.S. that targeted the carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuel power plants. But at the same time, it also brought down the levels of air pollution emissions. And in its first 5 years, the cleaner air during that time was credited with preventing hundreds of deaths, over 16,000 cases of respiratory illness in children, 540 new cases of childhood asthma and other illnesses, and the estimated cost savings were up to $8 billion.
It's too bad that in hospitals or in schools, people don't get passed out pieces of paper and just say, statistically, there's a good chance that your kid didn't have this problem because of what we did. It's so hard to measure these things. How do we notice that we're doing better all together when we make these systemic changes?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a matter of looking at population rather than trying to identify one particular cause of one particular case of illness. And we know that the causes of disease and impairment are multiple. But the good news is if environmental causes are by nature preventable. So if we move those from the, so to speak, the causal pie, we can actually prevent the disease. A lot of people haven't understood the full impacts of our addiction to fossil fuel. They haven't understood that not only are the emissions from coal and oil and gas and diesel the primary cause of global warming and climate change and all its impacts, but also responsible for 80% of toxic air pollution. And when you start to think in that way, holistically, of all of the combined impacts, you can flip that around in your mind and think of the tremendous benefits of intervening and changing this pattern and shifting to clean sources of energy, other ways of living on this planet. And you can see the full measure of the health benefits for children living now and also for future generations.
If you stop with the fossil fuels, not only do you clean up the air pollution and our health, but you also clean up the global climate change.
That's right. So in a sense, it's two for one. It certainly will have a huge payoff in terms of health and economic benefits. It's a heavy lift, and we know we have very little time to act. As the UN has told us, the window is very short and it's closing. But we also have the tools at hand to address these problems, and we know how to do this. So I think we should be encouraged by the information in the book about the success stories of policies and other strategies to address climate change, and in doing so, air pollution. And we should be encouraged by the trends in this country and globally to move in the right direction, to shift away from fossil fuel and to energy efficiency, invest in green energy. And these trends are reflecting a lot of the work that Indigenous and youth groups, groups of elders, groups of scientists, artists, and environmental organizations have done to bring attention and awareness to the problem and motivate policymakers and government leaders to act.
In your book, you suggest shifting from the question, how can we act in time to avoid disastrous global warming, to a question more like, what must we do to save the children? I think that's a really pivotal question. And so I wondered what you think Mother Earth wants when it comes to saving the health of our children.
I think Mother Earth wants us to wake up to the reality that children today and future generations need our help. Unless we all become engaged, their world will be a dangerous and unsustainable one, and we have failed in our responsibility. In addition to the health costs, which are now skyrocketing, there's a cost to society of children who grow up suffering from physical illness, developmental problems, and mental health issues that often persist throughout their lives and prevent them from reaching their full intellectual potential. I think Mother Earth also wants us to protect and strengthen the ecosystems and biodiversity that supports all life. And right now, 1 million plant and animal species on the planet are at risk of extinction, many within decades, because of human activities. And Barbara Colbert, in her book, The Sixth Extinction, makes this very clear. But again, action can make a difference, and there is no time to waste.
Yeah, now is the time.
Now is the time.
To close this interview, I'd like to ask you a few quick questions about your own personal relationship to Mother Earth, if you're game.
Sure.
As a kid, what was your favorite thing to do when you were outdoors in nature?
Well, one of my favorite things, and that I think is early on where the connection was formed, was during the summers at my grandfather's house, which was perched on the rocks above a white sandy beach. I had the chance with my siblings to wake up early and to leap from rock to rock down to the beach and explore the life in the new tidal pools that had been formed when the tide had come in. And that really made a wonderful impression on me.
Where was this house?
This was in Massachusetts, south of Boston, in a town called Cohasset. There were four of us, and we all loved to do this together and explore and say, look what we find. Look. It was most exciting and made us realize how very beautiful and diverse natural life is, and also how fragile.
Yes. Can you describe a scene in nature when you have felt true awe?
I first felt real awe in nature when I climbed my first mountain. It was Mount Washington in the White Mountains of New Hampshire. And then I renewed that sense of awe on other mountains around the world over different seasons. And one thing I think about often is the power of nature to renew herself. But now when I walk on beaches and hike on trails, I see the disruptions we've caused and realize that this power to renew is not limitless.
No, it has a finite measure. What's something that you wonder about in nature these days?
Well, I wonder about and marvel at how very important nature is to all life on the planet, obviously, and how our connections, direct connections to nature, make such a difference in our lives and in our children's lives. And I do worry about children who grow up in neighborhoods and cities where they never have a chance to be out in the countryside or on beaches or mountains or just out of the urban ecology, and they learn where all these creatures live and where food is raised and that not everything comes in plastic wraps, God forbid.
And finally, what is your favorite baby animal?
My favorite baby animal is a puppy, because when I was very young, our childhood dog was called Nifty. And she was adopted from the Animal Rescue League. And as she grew up with us, she kind of was like a nursemaid. She walked us to school every morning, and she would then return to school at lunchtime to escort us back home.
No parents, just the dog.
Just the dog. The
school was
nearby, and our parents trusted us. This was me and my siblings and some friends who lived on our street. And here was this lovely little dog who was our faithful companion, escort, and protector.
Oh, little Nifty. That's so sweet.
Yes.
Dr. Pereira, it is impossible to measure how much strife and suffering has been alleviated because of the research and communication you've done over the course of your whole career. No one will ever actually know that their child has avoided a complicated diagnosis because of your work, but it has clearly created a healthier world for many people. I am wowed by your career and so very grateful to have you on What Mama Wants today. Thank you for being my guest.
Kate, it has been my pleasure to be with you and to talk with you about this so important subject. And I'm very grateful to you for having me on your program.
Well, lucky us to get to hear right from the researcher's mouth.